PFT Media. Here we are, born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe. Here we belong, fighting to survive in a war with the darkest power.
Lights, camera, and at least 10 whole minutes of action. We are going to look at the early era of American and global film today on Half True History. Half True History, where we take the legends of yesterday, merge them with the facts of today, and come up with a pretty good story that you should find pretty entertaining there. I am your professor for the evening, Dan P. And broadcasting on the airwaves is super producer Chris Crespo.
Checking in from the studio. Hello there, Dan. Hello, Pedro.
And of course, as always, here to check out and be our ever-ready co-host, I want to say the W.E.B. Du Bois to my D.W. Griffith, Pedro Lima.
I'm not talking. I'm a silent film. I was looking for something to write down. I couldn't find a goddamn pen.
Nice.
Oh. I'm like, where the hell's the pen around here? I was just gonna go.
Pedro doing his Harpo Marx for today.
God damn it. Oh, that would have been great. A little horn. Just do this whole episode with.
So, movies. You're familiar with them, right, Chris?
I enjoy them quite a bit. Don't know much about the older movies, though. I mean, I think I've seen stuff from like the 30s and 40s.
Okay, but talk about the early years of cinema.
I think the oldest movie I've ever even tried watching might be Metropolis.
Metropolis. That's a good film, though.
Well, yeah, it's definitely striking to watch. It's from the 20s, mid-20s. Yeah.
But I think the oldest movie I've seen, it's A Wonderful Life. I think it's my
oldest movie you've seen?
Or...
Now, you've seen Wizard of Oz.
Wuthering Heights. Is Wuthering Heights older than...
I don't know. Have you seen King Kong?
I know about King Kong, but I can't tell you I've seen it.
That was one of my favorites in high school. For some reason, I watched the heck of it over and over. That's
I like the original King Kong. And then I watched it recently.
Yeah.
And then I realized just how racist that Chinese character was.
Oh my goodness! So much of it. The island, the natives on the island and stuff. It's a very racist, very very racist movie.
What you gonna do, old timers?
Yep, Wuthering Heights, 1939.
All right, so that's the oldest you've gone.
I think that's the oldest movie I can think of.
Same year as Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, and Gone with the Wind.
So I've seen Wizard of Oz. So
that's also 39.
All right.
Yep.
Well, film has been around for a decent amount of time, I would say, in American history, and it's become almost... I venture to say it's become almost one of our national art forms.
Okay.
And of course you get the high budget, the big popcorn stuff as you do with any type of culture, high culture. But then of course, even still today, we're making changes into film as art. And it's only appropriate that film did start with an artist. It was a photographic artist who is the inventor of the idea of stop motion. And he's going to come up with, is considered the first movie projector and the birth of cinema. He's a photographer by the name of Edward Muybridge. And he invents something called the zupraxoscope.
The zupraxo what?
Yeah, the zupraxoscope. And for those of you who don't know, that's that, and I'm sure you've seen it in film somewhere or in something, that's that wheel or canister with carousel. Yeah, with the little horse moving, or the as you spin it, or the guy walking around and then sitting down, mm-hmm. type thing. Yeah,
it's sort of like a the same idea behind a flip book,
right? Exactly, it's a flip book in front of a light. And the first one shows up in 1879. It's a huge hit. It is a donkey kicking his hind legs.
1879.
Yeah,
I'm thinking it's like way before, because. And I'm doing this based on Red Dead Redemption. So, playing that Western game, and they got like little movie theaters kind of thing. I'm like, okay.
They would have. Yeah, they would have, because that the Wild West, and we always think the Wild West is so far away too, but you're really, the West itself isn't tamed until 1900. So there probably might have been some of the early kinetoscopes out there, but not what you're thinking, like a theater as in like a projector with seats or anything. No, that wouldn't have shown up there yet. And so it's very popular, very smash hit. And so he decides that he's going to George R.R. Martin, his next one. So this came out in 1879. The next one doesn't come out until 1892.
Okay.
Wow.
It's a man riding a horse.
But that's the one everyone pictures when they think of it, though.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's the Godfather 2 to the donkey.
Now I've got two things on screen. Top it.
This guy's rolling on on dough.
Yeah. But before he's able to release his second big hit, there is already things in the works to try and make more motion pictures.
Okay.
A new type of machine that will take photographs and, again, do the very fast flipbook thing for the light. It was called the kinetoscope. So that was the device, and again, you've probably seen it in old movies and cartoons. That was the device that was this big box with some goggles sticking out of it, and then we would look into it and crank it and then watch whatever was there.
And how long were those little films, little shorts?
15, 20 seconds.
Yeah, they were short. Yeah.
Yeah. This is an Edison production. So Thomas Edison is the one who patents the kinetoscope. Notice I said patent, not invent.
because amateurs create and professionals steal.
Exactly. That's how it works, Tesla.
Absolutely. Get it right.
And Edison realizes this could be a big hit if he capitalizes now. So he is going to build an all-black building in order to, of course, you know, the light sensitivity of early cameras back then for motion picture development. The first movie studio in the world, and he's going to call it the Black Mariah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. It's a very ominous name for a production house.
Mm-hmm. It had to be very dark in there. Cameras at this point, movie cameras at this point were so sensitive you couldn't use natural sunlight yet. So it had to be a highly controlled dark room with the lights just as they needed to be, just enough to illuminate in order to capture the picture. And the very first motion picture to be copyrighted is one of his employees sneezing in 1894.
Oh.
Known as Fred Ott's sneeze.
What's the spelling of his last name?
Ott, O-T-T. And if you are, you can put it on YouTube. It's right there. It's all 5 seconds of it. Fred Ott sneezes.
Pretty crazy that that dude sneezed so long ago, and we could like watch it right now on YouTube.
Right?
That's pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. I just, yeah, it's just so crazy. And YouTube's got so
that's many. It?
Yeah.
That's it.
That, yeah.
What? Yo, that was a bitch-ass sneeze.
And people paid to watch that over and over. They did.
They'd never seen something before. Something live from all the way around. They could see it in real time.
Some people probably thought they were getting sneezed on.
Right. I mean, this was almost as good as going to a baseball game.
And with 100% less chance of getting punched in the back of the head.
Right. So Edison's going to be making all these little family-friendly, cheesy things, you know, a ballerina dancing or a couple kissing or something like that. You know, he just creates a series of these little 5-10 second things. All right. And everybody who wants to be a filmmaker has to use Edison's studio. It's the only studio at this time. So another group that wants to start up their own film company is the Kinetoscope Exhibition Company. And they like this idea. So they're going to rent out the studio from Edison, but they want the idea that we're going to get multiple film reels. Okay, so we can show people segments of something a little bit longer and they just watch each segment in order to see the whole thing.
Okay.
And I don't think this surprises anybody in America. As soon as we get the first viewing machine, we get the first company that is going to use this viewing machine to record sporting events and then sell it per view. It was a boxing match between Michael Leonard and Jack Cushing.
Nice.
That's what, yo, I have this right after stupid sneezing over here. Yeah.
First televised boxing event. Pay-per-view. Only on pay-per-view.
56 seconds. A whopping, but on their defense, that's like 800%. No. Yeah. 700%, something like that.
Yeah.
It's
good numbers. It's amazing. Long and everything. And it becomes so popular that they follow it up with the next thing. And they actually sign a boxer to a contract for, in order for them to film a certain number of his fights to show. His name is James Corbett. And so this boxer basically is, was it the boxer? I believe, yeah. So we're looking at like 1895, 1896, I believe. And that's considered the first movie star contract.
Wow. The
first contract in cinema history is not to an actor or a director, but to a boxer.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
From the Library of Congress. I'm sorry, but I got to watch this fight.
Yes. No, go ahead.
Yeah.
Narrate it. Tell us what happens, baby.
Dude, first of all, the guy's finding a thong. Like, he got wrestling tights on.
Okay.
Like, one guy has long johns.
Okay.
And then the other one's wearing some, like, Native American wrestling tight. Okay. Like, it's Macho Camacho fighting in a...
At least you can tell.
Not really getting the... They're throwing weird punches. It's not even boxing that you would think. It's closely more to MMA and wrestling.
Okay, so there's no gloves.
No gloves. They throw a punch, and if they don't connect, they go back. And they reset and unwind again.
Here comes old Hayward with the weak cross, and they hit him with the chicken feathers again. So is it a good fight or no? It's bad.
No,
fight. It's not. Don't recommend. A good fight. two thumbs down from Pedro Lima.
I definitely would not recommend.
All right, don't recommend. Good to know.
But film is catching on. It becomes really popular. It's a place to just sit and, you know, kind of watch something for a limited time, very limited time. Mm-hmm. By 1900, we have improved camera technology. We are now able to produce 10-minute films per reel.
So that's when the first movie hookup started.
This is when we're starting to get some real traction. We're starting to have like scenes and stories, not just people doing stuff. We're getting film studios that are appearing more than America. So Great Britain's got one, France has got one, Germany's got one, and of course, Russia has one. Mm-hmm. And Crespo can back me up. They go a little bit bonkers in Russia.
Oh my goodness. I mean, they already have the whole like Soviet propaganda machine and Russian propaganda machine through art. They've been doing that for so long. And then like the way they do it through movies and stuff is it's amazing. Tarkovsky, come on, Stalker.
Yeah. And so originally it's just little scenes and people acting and things like that. Obviously it's silent film and everyone's still doing everyday life until France decides to make a film.
Okay.
And the French, you know, they don't do that normal stuff. The Americans like we're not going to show somebody walking into a hotel and sitting in the bed. So a director named Georges Millet, who is nicknamed the Cinemagician, is going to redo Jules Verne's A Trip to the Moon. And I think you've seen at least one image of that movie.
This is the moon and the rocket lands on the moon's eye.
Yep.
It's on Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
It sings.
This is the first major special effects ever in a motion picture.
Oh, those French.
The scenery and everything, so it just changes the game. Everyone realizes you got to tell a story now that has stuff in it. Like you can't just go, we can't go back to people sneezing now.
No. That guy sneezing probably had his day in the sun thinking he's hot shit.
He's probably walking around with like a pocket of like a little thing of snuff.
Yeah, he's charging.
Like, waiting for people to ask him, are you the sneezing guy? Are you Frank Ott? What was his name?
Wow. He does this shit a lot in restaurants. He does this a lot when he pretends he's and people are like, oh, he's gonna do it. That's extra.
He's like the, and now he's the Jared of Subway.
Yeah, now no one wants to know him.
No one cares.
He's walking around sneezing in people's faces like, oh, Fred, get out of here, man.
Fred, done stop with that shit.
Yeah, man.
Nobody
you're going to give a Spanish flu.
Yeah, you sneezed in my salad. Get out of here, Fred.
So that's 1902. And have you seen the Voyage to the Moon before, Crespo?
I have watched some of it because when Martin Scorsese made Hugo and what's his name? Gandhi played Georges Méliès and showed they, you know, they recreate them making the studio inside like I think they converted like an old greenhouse or something. Mm-hmm. And making the movie and they show them making Trip to the Moon and all that stuff. So then I did go onto YouTube and like look up some old stuff.
And for 1902, it's really amazing what he did.
Yeah, I mean, he knew like match cuts and like very simple, what we consider very simple camera trickery.
Right.
He was like pioneering that stuff.
Yeah,
I think it's very cool.
First, he did like the fade in, fade out stuff.
Like, that's the thing. But you have to realize, like, just moving the camera at one time was a revolutionary idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's very cool what they were doing back then for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's why they called him the Cinemagician for what he did. But then the Americans are like, yo, we got to outdo this guy. This is our invention.
Yeah.
We can't let French people steal this. So they all get together. And a man by the name of Edwin S. Porter decides we're going to make a first full-length feature film in America.
Oh, okay.
12 minutes long.
Yep.
All right. And we are going to do it about the thing that makes Americans the most famous in the 1900s. Cowboys. I'm going to make a cowboy film.
Heck yeah.
All right. How much money we got? Got $150. Let's do it. And so for $150, which was the largest budget in motion picture history at that time.
Titanic type level. Yeah. Level that shit to inflation.
It was became a Rambo 3 of its day.
Yeah.
$3.3 billion.
It was like Endgame's got nothing.
Right, exactly.
It was called The Great Train Robbery.
Oh, classic.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly what you think it is, Pedro.
Cowboys. I think I've seen clips of it.
Yeah, cowboys robbing a train.
I think they use. Very quick clips of it in Tombstone in the beginning when they're doing like the cowboy montage, explaining who the cowboys are.
Okay.
I think they even use a clip from A Great Train Robbery as like an homage.
Oh, is it? Yeah, for that.
You know.
Well, it ends with a very, very famous scene, which is copied all over the world pretty much now in every action scene. It's the main character, aims at the camera and fires, and then it fades to black.
That's it. Yeah, that must be it, because that's what they show in Tombstone. They show a guy with a hat pointing his gun at the camera. He shoots, and then it says Tombstone. And it's startling. It's a weird image to see someone point a gun at the camera.
Yeah,
shoot it, because they're shooting it at you, the audience. Mm-hmm. Don't like dismiss that when a filmmaker wants you dead. Don't dismiss that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'll make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, be careful out there. Psychically, at least he's trying.
So yeah, it was the first blockbuster in American history, and this came out in 1903. It will be the highest grossing and most popular film in America for the next 12 years.
Wow. That's a good run.
Because if there's anything Americans will always buy, it's a cowboy or Civil War film at this time.
Oh, yeah. So the movie that dethrones it is a Civil War movie.
Yes. Well, it is.
Technically, it's a Reconstruction movie.
Right. It's got a great Civil War action scene, though.
Yeah, sure.
Way ahead of its time.
Definitely ahead of its time.
Pedro, have you heard of D.W. Griffith?
I think so.
Okay. D.W. Griffith is pretty much, I mean, you would call him the Orson Welles of the silent era, the Steven Spielberg of the silent, whatever director is groundbreaking.
The James Cameron of the 1910s of Los Angeles.
What movie did he put out?
Oh, he makes 500 pictures in his lifetime.
Okay.
The one we're going to talk about, of course, is his most infamous.
Mm-hmm.
So he's he's a genius. He really is a genius. You're talking about cinematography, action scenes, what's it called? Stories put together like no one has ever done before. And he's got films that are now going 2 hours long. And he wants to make a film based on an extremely popular novel called The Klansman.
Oh shit, what's the name of that?
This one's gonna be longer than all his others. 3 hours long.
Birth of a Nation.
Yep, the Birth there of a go. Nation.
There you go, Birth of a Nation. History written in lightning, says film critic Woodrow Wilson.
Yep. It is a 3 hour silent film which shows just how brave and heroic the Ku Klux Klan are, and they save the South after the Civil War from the out of control black people who didn't know what to do with their freedom.
So it's a KKK infomercial, pretty much.
It becomes their number one recruiting tool until the 1970s.
Yeah, at the time, the KKK was like done. They were dead. And that movie was like, hey, we got some life back.
It brought them back. 1915 is when the movie comes out. 1915 is when the second Ku Klux Klan starts in Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Like we were talking before, people watch a movie and they're like, yo, what? I want to be a Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
They're brave.
Yeah.
It's the first superhero movie.
Yeah.
Because they're costumed heroes with masks that come and save the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's the original Marvel.
It's the best-selling film until 1939.
Wow.
Yep. And then it's replaced by another Civil War film.
Yeah, Gone with the Wind.
Yep.
Which cast the South as the sympathetic side.
And so
I'll never be hungry again, even though they took away my slaves.
The secret to American success, ladies and gentlemen, whether you're making a film in the 1900s or running for president in the early 2000s, is racism.
Be racist. Be openly racist, and enough people will embrace it. Man, at the end of Gone with the Wind, when Atlanta is burning, oh, that's so feel good.
I never rooted for someone harder than the Union Army in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. It's like, yes, Sherman, go.
Yeah. I'm like, keep going. Burn it all.
Why'd you stop?
I know. And they act like they treat him like Godzilla.
Yeah.
Destroy Tokyo.
Yeah, for real. Oh, man. It's fantastic. I love it.
Right. And because after that, such horrible things like black people smiling in the streets.
Yeah, it's terrible. How is O'Hara going to get her carrots?
Yeah.
It is a white. But that's the thing, though. So movies like Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, also, they're, especially for their times, like, extremely well-made.
That's the problem. You can't erase them from film history because they're groundbreaking.
They're too good. Gone with the Wind is, like, an amazing to look at movie when you consider the time period and all that. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And the same thing with Birth of a Nation. Like, if you're going in and looking at it from a technical perspective, you just hate how good he is at his job.
He invented, like, the crane shot, D.W. Griffith. He did a, for his Birth of a Nation sequel, essentially, Intolerance. I'm thinking of a different movie. Babylon is another
Babylon.
One. Yeah, for Babylon, he wanted this giant shot. That was like, it had 200 extras and it had these huge elephants and elephant statues. And I'm talking like 100 feet tall. And he wanted this huge crane shot, but they didn't have cranes back then. So they had to build a moving elevator that they put the camera on top of. And as it would move forward like a car, and then the elevator would lower with the camera on it. And then if you look at it, it just looks like an amazing, gigantic crane shot. But it is 100%. They had to invent a huge apparatus just to get this thing. And at the time, it blew people's minds. That's how forward-thinking he was with movies.
And he was, I think he was one of the first ones to put cameras on wheels to follow the action, right?
Yeah. I mean, the things that we so take for granted, the stuff that we see in Snickers commercials, they had to invent. They had to think about it and invent it.
Yep.
And then they did it and they made racist stuff.
And it, you know, and it wasn't like there were no critics. The NAACP tried to boycott this film and tried to ban the film in America for months before its release.
Yeah, there were still protests and stuff. Like, not everyone was dumb back then.
Like that, if you do boycott and stuff like that, all it's going to do is bring attention to people.
Exactly.
And they're like, oh, well, let's see what this is. I don't see the problem with this.
So to his legacy, I'm not going to say to his credit, to his legacy, though, D.W. Griffith swore he did not understand the negative reaction or the negative message that it was going to send. He was more interested. He was so wrapped up in the art that he was making, he didn't understand the message he was sending out. Or so that's his statement.
Yeah, he was like supposedly more into making an epic war movie that the racist overtones of the Klansmen.
It didn't click.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I mean, it's hard to say back then. Obviously, people thought differently. Culture was different. Mm-hmm. There's a different level of ignorance at the time.
If there's anyone who I would give the benefit of the doubt to, it is D.W. Griffith, just because when you read about his personality, you're looking at this very Van Gogh style person who really got so absorbed in his work, he did not recognize the outside world until the project was done.
That's true. To his detriment sometimes too.
Yeah.
He would just, like Babylon, since we mentioned mm-hmm. it was one where he spent so much time making it that people were like, well, where's the final product? He had to keep borrowing money. He had to put his own money into it. And then it ended up being hit. It's like, how many times could he do that? You know?
And over again, he does it. He just makes hits after hits. And
yeah, it's crazy.
When he hears about when the backlash finally sinks in, he decides to make amends and he makes another film, Intolerance, which is another 3-hour spectacle about racism over the years and bigotry over the years and throughout history.
So it's like showing stuff from like ancient Egypt, like Romans enslaving people and stuff like that. It's four different storylines that are being intercut together. So he's also cross-cutting four different stories that is linking together thematically.
And how long were these movies from this guy?
3 hours.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so think about it, Pedro. Movies went from 12 minutes to 3 hours in a matter of like 5 years. It became a competition of sorts amongst a handful of filmmakers, Griffith among them, where, and they counted them by reels. So they're like, I want to make a 5-reel movie. Well, I'm going to make an 8-reel movie. I'm going to make a 12-reel movie. And the more reels of film that it took to show your movie, it was like a bigger feather in your cap sort of thing.
Yeah. And then you could charge a dime for the ticket.
A whole dime, buddy.
I like the sound of that, boys. So, and Intolerance obviously does not have the fame behind it, but it is also an extremely well-made movie. Once again, it's another hit, knocks out of the park. Like, he really is this beautiful mind type of figure, like, when it comes to his work. He just doesn't understand. I think he was probably had some, today we call it on the spectrum. And I could guarantee you, if we tested him back then, there might have been some kind of spectrum dissociation with the public, you know, and with social norms with him.
Yeah, I could definitely buy that, the way he, his relationships with people. Mm-hmm. And the way he worked with others and stuff, and his dedication to his singular vision.
Yeah.
It's almost stereotypical in a way. Like, I don't want to be like dismissive or like, oh, he's on the spectrum, that type of thing. But I think it's a very valid observation.
Yeah, absolutely. And with race being not the biggest issue of what it was back then, you know, I could see him not even picking up on the overtones,
sure.
Like you said.
Yeah.
Not even like understanding it. And then he sees the backlash and then he realizes, oh, I have to put this right. And so then he goes the other way and tries to put that in.
Yeah. It's like, look at it. Humans have been bad to each other since the beginning. Look at this. Yeah. And then audiences were like, yeah, we guess.
it's like the film industry became woke from the same director right away.
Yeah. It was almost like an oops.
Yeah, which is great, though. Like, you don't see people apologize like Griffith did, though, anymore. Like, I mean, I will never forgive him for creating that piece of garbage, that beautiful piece of garbage.
Yeah, but that moved the art form forward, but then it's like, what did it do socially? So, yeah, there's definitely a give and take there.
It's such a give and take. But Intolerance is a really good movie. And I believe recently the AFI replaced Birth of a Nation with Intolerance as far as their greatest movies of all time.
Didn't they remake Birth of a Nation?
They did. They didn't remake it. They took the title and they made it about the Nat Turner Rebellion.
Yes. Exactly. What's his name? Nate Parker? I think his name is.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that they took that title. Mm-hmm. Like, no, the Birth of the Nation is about slaves rising up, you know, and trying to fight back. So I appreciate that. Technically, it's different because either I think it has the. So I think it's the Birth of a Nation. Like one of them has the article the, and one of them doesn't.
Yeah, I think the is the Griffith one.
Might be the original, yeah. And then Birth of a Nation is the newer one, which is a kind of, you know, because it's a sort of gritty, dark, obviously slave movie. Mm-hmm. At times hard to watch, but I gotta recommend it. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, I haven't checked it out yet, but I was interested when I heard about it.
I'd say it's worth watching it at least once. It's got some really good stuff in there.
I like 12 Years a Slave. Is it?
It's actually 12 Years a Slave is excellent. In comparison, Birth of a Nation is almost more accessible because it does turn into more of a thriller when it gets to the rebellion stuff. And
I just hate watching
the inhumanity of the slavery. And that's what I'm saying. Birth of a Nation shows you that. Like it, in my brain, there's already a couple of images that I can't get out that as I talk to you about the movie, I'm thinking of.
Birth of the Nation?
The new one, Birth of a Nation. The newer one, the slave one.
Okay.
So it's like, be careful. You're going to see things that are going to be like, oh, well, that's brutal.
I don't want to see that shit. I'm good.
Yeah. I'm telling you, it's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, I'll check it out. I'll check.
Give me the Disney version of it.
Hey, Song of the South?
Yeah, Song of the South. Zippity doodah.
Zippity doodahs.
Yeah, so then movies become they realize they become more of a major production. Plus, by 1914, 1915, Edison was being a dick and charging way too much for his studio use.
Mm-hmm. So, and he had patents on everything. So you had to pay all the different licensing fees to Edison if you even wanted to make a movie.
Right. And then, so Crespo, the remedy for it, the solution that D.W. Griffith and others have?
United Artists, right?
Was that not yet? But just moving the venue completely.
Oh, well, because Edison's in Jersey,
mm-hmm.
Wizard of Menlo Park, and D.W. Griffith and all of them are in New York. So they just pick up and move to Los Angeles.
Yep, they just, by 15, they're all out there. And by 1920, you're looking at four major studios ready to change the world.
Yeah, New York for a second was like the movie making capital. And then it got moved to brand new Hollywood, California.
Hollywood land.
Yeah, Hollywood land. Come down to Hollywood land. Brand new homes. We swear we have water for everyone.
Swear. So, and then it just took off after that. The 1920s were the golden age of silent films.
Mm-hmm.
This is where you get all your slapsticks, some of your great action stars, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., you've got, of course, Valentino. You've got Buster Keaton, Lillian Gish, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin. Yeah, this is where it all happens.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Lloyd, I love
him. You get the first TMZ with the Hildenburg disaster.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, speaking of disasters, no, you do have your first Hollywood scandal right away.
Are you talking Fatty Arbuckle?
We are talking Fatty Arbuckle.
Yes.
Oh.
I think that needs to be an episode on itself, though. What do you think?
It could be. Yeah.
Let's save that in the...
It's juicy.
That guy was like a sexual deviant, right?
I don't think so.
That was the image that ruined his career, but he was actually found to be innocent on all the charges.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. But yeah, essentially that was it. He was done.
And it is, you're right. It's like the first big Hollywood scandal.
Most big Hollywood scandal, right.
And then there happened to be a couple of them in a row.
Yeah.
In the 20s, like right after that, it got a little messy there for a second. Like Hail Caesar, Coen Brothers messy.
Yeah, I got a little Black Dahlia after that.
Yeah, a little Black Dahlia.
Oh, Fatty.
But then, like Crespo was saying, yeah, the studios had a really tight hold of creative control, these four studios, and it was really hard to work with them. So Griffith and Chaplin and Pickford and Fairbanks and some others form United Artists, the first artist-run studio in 1919, mm-hmm. Where they could actually keep their own ideas and they could basically just George Lucas it and get to keep all the rights to their films.
And it's amazing that United Artists, at least like as a label in some way, is still around today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's still United Artists Theaters.
Yep.
I don't know what they're doing, if anyone's using it as for the where the library is at, but you know, that library is in existence. Someone owns it. So.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, UA is out there.
Yeah, I wonder who owns that. Yeah, that's a nice selection of films, too. That's
Hollywood history right there.
Yeah. It's some of the best minds there. So.
Yep.
Yeah, and then. And the silent era will go till 1927. We'll end that. And another groundbreaker and another racist movie.
Al Jolson, baby.
Mama. Mama.
You ain't seen nothing yet, no. Pedro.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
The first movie with sound was about blackface performing.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
You really got it.
You want to be successful in America? Be racist, Pedro.
You really got to shine a brighter light on our history.
Yeah.
Got to get over it.
And then even when
it's a racist country, dude. It's a racist country. That's what people. You guys don't understand. The people that are in charge are old people that grew up with these films.
Yeah.
So these are the good old days. This is what they want to bring back.
Yeah, when they say "Make America Great Again," this is what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, make this all cool again.
Yeah, when blackface was just socially acceptable and you didn't have to be hunted down as a white man for doing blackface. You know, the good times.
And then even when they remade it in the 70s with Neil Diamond, they still had a scene where he had to fill in for his friend's like all black band. So yep. They put him in blackface.
Listen, bro, 1980 Soul Man. Suck it.
I mean, at least in Tropic Thunder, like, it was the point to be this is
that was the point of it.
Yeah. It was a parody. It was a parody. Yeah,
at
it
the
was
very least. And then I guess it's also like the last time blackface should be done in any form in entertainment.
Listen,
unless of course, yeah, you're doing it obviously to point out the negatives.
Yeah, to skewer it. But now you have to do it better than Tropic Thunder.
Yeah,
is the thing. Yeah,
and so Mad Men.
Did Mad Men do it? I haven't seen the Mad Men.
Yeah, Mad Men did it.
All right, very good. Good. Well, good for Mad Men.
Yeah, like
they did the TV version.
It's to that point where it's like, you can't. But I mean, you could still be the Prime Minister of Canada doing blackface. So
that's true too. Yeah, and he's super liberal. Everyone loves him.
Yeah, but hey, maybe mistakes were made. And at least he apologized like D.W. Griffith.
Didn't he do black hands too?
I don't remember.
I think he also blacked his hands up. I mean,
did he black his hands up? Well, at least
James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones was in Soul Man.
James Earl Jones signed off on that movie?
He was in that movie. He had scenes with C. Thomas Howell. Yeah, I remember that movie. That movie made me laugh so hard during the basketball scene. Because I didn't know it was like, I think I saw it. I was in Puerto Rico when I saw it.
Right.
So to us, it's like, hey, we didn't see anything.
It was the 80s. None of us saw anything. It was fine. It was fine.
Leslie Nielsen is in that movie.
Oh.
Rest in peace. Is he dead?
He's dead.
Yes.
Rest in peace.
Father from Alf was in it.
Oh, good.
Oh, that guy was found in a motel room with crack cocaine at one point, I think.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus was in it.
Oh, she is a dream.
Ron Reagan was in it.
Son of?
Ronald McDonald.
Cool. All right.
First clown president.
Yeah. All right. Well, at least he kept his father's tradition of being in really shitty movies.
Yeah.
Ali, yeah. His father. Let me stop. Go.
We haven't done a Reagan episode, have we?
No.
Can we just finish Reagan for like 30 minutes one day?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Let's do that. Okay.
That'd be great. All these dudes are like, we're Reagan Republicans. I'm like, do you really want to be a Reagan Republican?
Ronald AIDS what? Reagan?
Yeah, exactly.
That was the first president when I was having this conversation with Angel about it.
Yeah.
Was that's the first president when I was young that I realized, oh, that's the first president I remembered. Mm. And I was like, oh, shit, he wasn't that bad. You know, oh, shit, they tried to shoot him. He was quick with the one-liners. And then you get older and you see all the shit that he did and be like, oh, shit. Okay.
I think it's a hard lesson for a lot of people. And this is, again, going back to that kind of make America great thing. People have a hard time separating the idea of just because you had a good childhood doesn't mean the country was good.
Yeah.
Just because it was good for you doesn't mean other people were happy.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah, I had fun in the 90s. Bill Clinton let the Hutu chop up the Tutsi. Like, you got to understand these things.
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective. Mm-hmm. Speaking of perspective, can I show you guys something?
Sure.
I'm gonna do the old share screen.
All right. The new toy found.
And then going back to the beginning of the episode, because we were talking about Zoetropes and the original Zoetrope, I wrote it down. Edward Muybridge and his Zoopraxiscope.
Yeah.
I saw this thing on Twitter like a month or two ago, and someone did a Zoetrope of someone walking through a door, and and then they put it on a record player on a turntable.
Mm-hmm.
And it is crazy looking. So I'm gonna show it to you now. So here we go. And if people want to look for this, I found it on reddit.com and it's labeled Zoetrope Animation. Do you guys see it?
Yep.
All right, here we go. Check this out. It's only 30 seconds. This guy has placed it on the turntable and it's a picture of a woman. It's a Zoetrope of a woman. It's 3D printed of a woman walking through the door. And here he goes. He turns it on. And there you go. It just fully looks like like each door is standing still and they're walking through it.
Yeah. How fast is that shit going?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Like the frame rate on that. And it's, I don't know, I think it's pretty crazy looking. When he mentioned Zoetropes, I was like, I saw a Zoetrope recently. Let me show it to these guys. So that's it. Show and sell's over.
Cool.
Pay your nickel and get out.
Yeah, for real. No, that was at least 7 cents worth of entertainment there.
And with that, I think we better get out of here so the ushers can clean the aisles. And thank you all for listening to Half True History. Keep up with us as well as the entire PFT family. This is probably going to be our first episode of the new year.
Yes, it is. Happy New Year, everyone. 2021.
Happy New Year to 2021.
We're only a few days away from Inauguration Day, actually.
Yeah. And to our future selves, we hope there is a president. Have fun with that.
There is. There is, hopefully. Yeah. And for those taking the vaccine, sorry about your foot.
So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you all for listening. This has been Half True History, and we will see you on the next page.
Keep wearing masks, stupid.
A PFT Media production.